Okay, then if you've got a bit of a list, I wonder if we can do, do you remember Sesame Street? So you have a letter and a number. So what letters will the new creation not be brought to you by? Okay, so any on your list, any kind of letters, kind of clumping things that won't be there? I've got a letter that I think is big. D. D is a good letter. So what won't be there begins with D?
Death.
Death.
Disease.
Disaster. Destruction. Dumbness. Doom. Despair. Darkness. Decay. So yeah, lots of D. And that's good. Doubt. Any other letters that won't be brought to you by? S is a good one. What S's have we got?
Sin.
Suffering. Shame. Sadness. Well, interesting. Yeah. From what Jesus says. Yeah. Suffering. What else do we have? We had. Just someone said Satan.
Satan.
Serpent. There's quite an interesting one. There's no more sea, so therefore no surfing and no sand and no sailing and no, you know, so all those things. No sea kayaking. I'm not sure that's actually right, but it. Yeah. Good. So. We have a great picture of where we're heading. I want to just give you I hope the colours come across a bit, just a picture of, that's the whole diagram, just so you know how big you need to draw it. Yeah, don't worry. So we've got the outside, you don't need to draw it now. We've got the outside half of the Bible in sort of blue there, of where we started, where we're going to. The red is the prototype. The red bit is the prototype, the green bit is the real rescue when Jesus arrives, and then the yellow bit is a bit of a puzzle. So if the rescue comes at the point Jesus comes in green, where are we living now? Why are we not in the new creation yet? And one thing that a Bible overview does is help us orientate properly where we actually live. Okay, does that make sense? So what we're doing now is the pink bits as we build up the prototype. So we've got quite a lot of bits on there, and I hope this helps. The idea is that next time you open up a bit of the Old Testament, it's all a bit weird, you don't really know where you are. What I'm hoping is you'll be able to put yourself on the diagram and kind of work out what is it we're building at the moment. And in particular, if you can try and work out which bit of the promise is this chapter all about. So for instance, anything about babies, which bit of the promise are we building? People. Yeah, so there's lots about people who can't have babies, or people who have lots of babies, or people who have too many wives and too many babies. Lots of people. What about bits about, let's say, sort of wells or cities? There's lots about wells in Genesis. What are we building there? Place. Yeah. Lots of stuff about place. We buy a field. Why are we buying a field? Why do I care? We're building place. So that's sort of where we've got to. We've done people. We've done place. Let's see if we can get that. There we go. We've done people. We've done place. So then I assume over coffee you talked about nothing else other than when do we get the relationship? What did you think? When do we get the relationship? Anyone have any ideas? Say again? Tabernacle. Yeah, thank you. So tabernacle, big tent, is all about the relationship. Thank you. Any other different ideas? Ten Commandments, thank you, is all about relationship, actually. Yeah, thank you. Any other ideas?
The flood.
The flood, gone white. Yeah, thank you. And actually, all the way through, you have individuals who have a relationship with God, a very good, close relationship with God. Yeah, thank you. Any others?
Deuteronomy.
Yeah, why Deuteronomy?
At the end, before they're coming, preparing to enter the land, they set out kind of conditions for entering the land, and then blessing.
Yeah. Thank you. Conditions for blessing and cursing, blessing, relationship. Yeah, thank you. Any more?
Obedience.
Yeah. Whereabouts are you thinking in the story? Yeah, yeah, that actually obedience is, again, a relationship category. That's brilliant. I think basically relationship comes up all the way through, and you might want to, we'll see at the end whether we know where we are going to put the tick. But it's the real drama in the story is about relationships. So, for example, Exodus, turn up Exodus again. Exodus is clearly a book about a rescue. You have plagues, you have let my people go, you have Passover, you have the Red Sea, you have the people on their way out. But actually, that bit is only 15 chapters in a 40-chapter book. So if you did Sunday school, everything you ever really did in Sunday school is only 15 chapters in a 40-chapter book. The biggest deal in Exodus is all about relationship. So we're going to... there we are, relationship. We're on the handout. It's because Exodus starts with Moses on Mount Sinai meeting God. He's an individual who meets with God. And Moses is told to go and get God's people, get the new nation of Israel, and bring them out of Egypt and bring them to Sinai to meet their God. So can we have the next... Where do we get to? If we still remember who the next person is, can we read Exodus 3, verse 12, please?
And God said, I will be with you, and this will be a sign to you, that the sign will send to you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain.
Thank you. And if your Bible has a footnote, you'll need it for the last you. So he's talking to Moses, I'll be with you, just Moses. You will be, the sign will be for you. But then he says, you will worship God on this mountain. And suddenly the you is plural. You're going to go and get my people, and they will worship here, serve me here. And that is a relationship God. So a relationship word. So Exodus is actually a journey to meet their gods. People are going to meet their God. And it's not a very smooth journey, but they do get there. Exodus 19 is the high point where they arrive at Sinai. And this time, instead of a burning bush, you have, verse 18, a burning mountain. And their relationship with God begins. So could someone read 19 verses 4 to 6, please? Thank you. Do you hear relationship? I brought you to myself. You will be my treasured possession. Or next person, read 20 verse 2. If we go back a row.
Yep. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery.
Thank you. You will be my people, I will be your God. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of slavery. So we're rescued from Egypt for a relationship with God. But it is still a relationship with a ruler. So just like in the garden there are rules, did you hear that in 19 verse 5? If you obey me fully and keep my covenant. And it's there, it's sort of about relationship retention, isn't it? If you keep these rules, then you'll stay in the relationship. But the rules are also, as we said over here, are also part of God's blessing. So 20 verse 2, I rescued you. Then at once, 20 verse 3, the Ten Commandments. And just notice the order those come in. So it has never been the deal at any point in God's dealings that an enemy of God could keep enough of God's rules and become his people. It's never been possible to earn your way into relationship with God. The people of Israel, they are already his people before they even hear the Ten Commandments. They're his people because God has stomped all over Egypt. He's kicked sand in Pharaoh's face, drowned his army, and brought them on eagle's wings to be his treasured possession. It's only then do they hear the Ten Commandments. And because God is a good God, the rules are part of his blessings. He's with them to protect them, to bless them, and to tell them what to do. And it's interesting, we are so independent-minded that we find that very hard to understand. That actually it could be part of God's blessings that he'd tell us what to do. But his rules are so good. He says things like, please don't murder each other. Don't steal from each other. Don't lie to each other. Stay faithful in your relationships. In fact, the rules are so good that all the nations round about are supposed to stare in at the prototype and say, wow, who is your God? These rules are brilliant. Who's your God? Again, our aim is we could put you down blindfolded anywhere in the Bible and you'd know roughly what it's about. So I don't know if the law was on your list of confusing bits or hard bits. That's the purpose of the law. Exodus 19, Exodus 20. Part of the blessing, part of staying in the relationship. Okay, but do you want to tick yet? Maybe. But actually, if you've read Exodus before, you'll know that what happens after the Ten Commandments is chapter after chapter after chapter of stuff about a tent. So if you ever tried to do Exodus in your quiet times and do kind of chapter a day, and it's all quite fun with the plagues, and then you hit these kind of knitting instructions about a tent. A very big tent, often called the tabernacle, and the promise is there in 25 verse 8 and 9. Could next person read 25, 8 and 9? Thank you. So these are camping instructions, but the person going camping is God. The point of the tent is it's a place for God to dwell among them. So again, remember, we're trying to get our way back to, it's not there, get our way back to Eden. So we want God to be with us, in the middle of us. And the good thing about a tent is a tent can go with them wherever they go, which means God can be with them wherever they go. So there on the diagram, that is meant to be a drawing of a tent. That's just appeared. That's the tabernacle. And we think, what a business. You know, why don't they just have God dwelling with them by his spirit like we do? And what is all this effort for? And the reason is because of how scary it is to have a relationship with a God of absolute holiness if you are a sinner. So could we have Exodus 20, verse 18 and verse 19 read?
Now when all the people saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off and said to Moses, "You speak to us and we listen, but do not let God speak to us lest we die."
Thank you. They come to the mountain to meet God and they are terrified. And they say, "Don't let him speak to us or we'll die." And they are right to feel that way. Repeatedly through from Exodus to Deuteronomy, we get this note of danger. Knowing God is dangerous. And I think we are so used to being forgiven, we're so bored of being forgiven, that we forget what it's like. Chapter 19, they're told, don't come too close or it will kill you to meet God. If a sinful person comes face to face with God, they come face to face with the eternal judge. And God is not a sort of bored paper pusher about sin. It's not kind of, oh, there's another sin, ka-ching, put it in the file. And God feels passionately. For example, because he cared about his people, he really cared about Pharaoh killing them and abusing them and misusing them. So I don't know, you read the papers, and the way that you or I feels about a rape or a murder, when you read it in the paper, God feels that infinitely deeply. And he feels it as the creator of the person who's been hurt, as the maker and owner of that person. So to walk into God's presence with sin is to walk in as a declared traitor or rebel. Genesis 3, I want to be God. I want to overthrow you and kill you. And every kind of smaller sin, every lie, every angry thought is just a small signal that I'm still continuing that rebellion. I'm still doing what Adam did. So they're given a hope of a relationship with God. They're given a tabernacle, place for God to dwell, but they fear God, and they're right to, because no sooner is Moses up on the mountain getting the knitting instructions than Exodus 32 happens. So Exodus 32, they collect together all of their gold, and they make an image of a golden calf, and they worship that, and they say, "That is our God that brought us out of Egypt." Which commandments have they broken? Yeah, it's only the first two. Commandment number one and commandment number two. Which means the promises are under threat. EastEnders, dum dum da da dum. They've rebelled against God. They've broken the first two commandments. surely they're all going to be destroyed. And there we have a very basic problem to take through all of the Bible, actually. How can sinners have a relationship with God? How can that work? And the answer is grace. The answer is God's grace. Is God being generous and giving freely what is not deserved? And the camping tent building section, again, it depends if you ever actually finished Exodus, but did you notice that gets repeated? So again, there you are, you're on the DLR to Canary Wharf each morning, you're trying to read Exodus chapter a day, and you get through the tent building stuff, and you think, oh, phew, I've finished that. We get into the golden calf, and it's all a bit more exciting again. And then 2 pages further on, we have 7 more chapters of identical instructions about this wretched tent again. Why? And why is it repeated? I heard the chief rabbi speaking on this once, the last one, Jonas. I went to hear him, and I was with a group of clergy who didn't really like the Bible, so they were pretty angry that he was using the Bible and explaining. He did it pretty well, until he got to this bit, where he said, why does it come twice? And his idea was this. He said, I think it's because to create a nation, you need to give the people something to do. So they need to build a tent. It's really important. Give them something to do. I think that is the opposite of why it's there. We get the instructions, then we completely mess up Exodus 32. We need to be destroyed. But then God forgives us and actually says, do you know what? Let's build the tent anyway. The thing that we did was worship a golden calf. That's what we contributed to the building of this nation. What they contributed, what God does is say, I will forgive you, and I am going to live with you after all, because of what he's like. So can the next person read Exodus 34, verse 6 and 7, which is a crucial turning point in the middle of that danger. Thank you. So as well as caring about sin and not kind of just letting it go, he is also merciful and gracious. In fact, again, this is all over the whole story. Why didn't God just give up after Genesis 3? Or why not destroy everybody and start again? Because he is merciful and gracious. So God stays with them. And by the end of the book, next person read Exodus 40, verse 34. Thank you. They finally build the tent and God comes to be in it. But we should still feel very, very nervous. How is this relationship going to go on? Next person read us verse 35.
And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it and the glory of the Lord filled the tent.
So there is a problem. God's in the tent, but even Moses can't go in. Can you picture it? They finally built the tent. They've done all the knitting. God's there. Brilliant. Verse 35, it's called the tent of meeting, but we have a problem because not even Moses can actually go in and meet with God. So Exodus ends with that puzzle. How can a sinful people meet with God? And the very next thing that happens is Leviticus chapter 1. Just can we have verse 1 and verse 2? Thank you. From out of the tent, God speaks to Moses and begins to talk about offering animals. So again, from our drawing, we know that sin leads to death. So the only way to deal with sin is if there is a death. And Leviticus 17, next person, just read verse 11, tells us why animals have blood. Any, I don't know, biologists here will disagree with this maybe, but tell us why they really have blood. Thank you. So animals have blood, not mainly for respiration and travelling food around the body, mainly for the atonement. Atonement's a word that means covering over of sin. Animals have blood so that we can cover over our sin. Here in the prototype, we deal with sin by killing animals. And Leviticus is a book that is full of blood. Page after page of blood. There are dead goats and dead bulls and dead chickens. I don't know if there's any vegetarians here. Leviticus is not the book for you. There is kind of sizzling animal fat. You have to wave bits of cow in the air. You have to flick blood on everybody. It's just dripping with buckets full of blood all the way through. Because to keep sinful people in a relationship with God, you have to deal with their sin by killing animals. And the high point here is the Day of Atonement, which is chapter 16. And can we just have a go in groups again and pick one of those sections and just say what happens to sin and how do you feel about it if you're an Israelite watching? Just give you a couple of minutes. Okay, should we come out together? And again, you have to say it's quite a gruesome story. Once you begin imagining what it would actually look like, I've looked at this with youth groups and kids groups before. Normally, I bring a couple of cuddly toys, to bring two little fluffy rabbits or two little bears, and then a really big kitchen knife is what you need, and then you get them to act it out. And it's astonishing how children look really innocent until you give them a knife and a fluffy bunny's head to saw off. And they get quite, it's probably not very health and safety at that point, but it makes the point. So what is it that happens to sin? I think several things we're learning here that go in the pattern. So sin, we learn, needs to be transferred. Did you spot that? I have to get sin away from me, otherwise I'm terrible trouble. So you get the goats and you lay your hand on them and you transfer the sin of the people onto the two goats. And then we need two goats to show two slightly different things. So one goat gets the punishment, doesn't it? So that's the goat that you let little Doris cut the head off. And that is the goat that is killed. And the blood goes inside the tabernacle to the very heart where God dwells. And there is a death for my sin. The punishment has been done. But the other goat gets to carry my sins. And it takes them all on its back. And it carries them miles and miles away into the wilderness. And just to check, when you were reading that, don't think happy goat heading off into freedom and a life in the wild. And the goat is going off into the desert where there are lions and where there is death. No water and where there is death. So the goat is, we're saying, bye-bye sins. My sins are going and I feel free. They've been taken away from me and I am clean. Verse 30, for another year I'm clean. For another year the relationship with God can go on and that feels great. And again, as we've said several times, if we've been reading all the way from Genesis 1 and 2, we might not still be fully satisfied. So God is with his people, but he's in a tent that only the high priest can go in. And these offerings, they need doing so much. Because there's so much sin. And the people have said, don't speak to us, God. We only want to hear you through Moses. In fact, it looks like sin is still dominating this relationship. And actually, if we're saying, what is this prototype for? I think we need to say that's the answer. This prototype, if a prototype racing car is all about speed, this prototype is all about sin. That's what this is for. The Bible actually is all about sin. Christianity is a rescue religion. It's a religion about how to be rescued from sin. And if, again, there's lots of competing versions of Christianity around, aren't they? And if you think Christianity is basically about something else, then you're going to struggle to make lots and lots of the Bible fit because so much of it is about sin. And actually, through the early books of the Bible, you can see a focusing in on a few individuals who have to work on sin for us. Because of sin, they have to stand between God and us and his people. So sin technicians. So there's the relationship, there's God, there's us. Something to go in between. And I wonder how you or your friends would answer the question of what is basically wrong with the world. And how you answer that question, a good way to get at it is to say, what do you think this world needs? What kind of technicians does this world need to fix what's wrong with the world. So if you mainly think the world needs education, then the sort of technicians we need are teachers, or thinkers, writers, something like that. If you think what's basically wrong in the world, what we need is charity work, then the technicians we need are NGO workers or social workers, something like that. If you think what's basically wrong in the world is lack of money, then we need bankers, or we need capital, we need investors. What is it the Bible thinks is mainly wrong with the world, and what do we need to put in place? Well, we've seen already the high priest in Leviticus 16. We need somebody to make sacrifices because of the guilt that sin causes. We've also said that they need Moses to speak for them, to God for them. Just turn on to Deuteronomy 18, and we'll give that its proper name, which is prophet. So Deuteronomy 18, could someone just read us verse 16? Deuteronomy 18, next lesson.
This is the desire of the Lord, your God, that part of you, in the day of the assembly, when you said, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord, my God, or see his great fire in my lest I die.
Thank you. So that's what we saw in Exodus, isn't it? They said, don't speak to us. Verse 17 here says that is the right thing for them to say. And the answer is a prophet. A prophet like Moses to stand in between them and God. So here's something interesting. Prophets are not mainly fortune tellers. Prophets are not mainly about telling the future. Their first job is relationship, communication with God because of sin. What prophets do is they stand in between a holy God and a sinful people, and they do the talking so that we can know God. But there's a problem because Deuteronomy 18 sets up that we're going to need another prophet, verse 18. But the book ends, 34 verse 10. Could someone read that? Thank you. We're still looking. We're still looking for somebody like Moses to do that. So you see how we're beginning to look for these people. We're looking for a crusher, and now we're looking for a new Moses and a good high priest. Then the third area this happens in is in the area of leadership. So the people are unable to stop sinning. They can't stop sinning. And very quickly, the Bible begins zooming in on a king as the answer to that. And I think we're very, very cynical about leadership. Politicians are all liars. They're all in it for themselves. And we forget what a good thing leadership is. We forget what real political instability is like, unless you happen to be from a country that has experienced genuine political instability. You forget what a good thing it is to have a king, to have a leader. And the book of Judges is the first book of what happens in the land when they get there. And leadership is the big problem in there. They start well enough, but there are enough of the old inhabitants left that Israel begins to behave just like them. They begin to turn into Canaanites. And we try temporary leaders, and things go okay while you have the leader, but then the leader dies, and we're back to square one. And we begin to say we need a king. So Judges 17 verse 6, Judges 18 verse 1, Judges 21, 25. Say, in those days there was no king in Israel. And that means everybody did what was right in his own eyes. Without a king, sinful people just do whatever they think is right. And Judges 17 to 21, that is true. Those are the bits they never let you read in Sunday school. And they are truly grisly stories. I had to preach on them not so long ago. And at the 6 p.m. congregation at St. Helens, there are never any children there. Children never come. But those weeks, every week, there was a six-year-old there. And it was just embarrassing. Like, it was a different one each time. I don't know where they came from. But it was embarrassing because Judges 17 to 21 are truly horrific. Cowardice, gang rape, mass killings, near genocide. One whole tribe is nearly wiped out. What's that? That's a threat to the promises. The nation of Israel is going to get destroyed. And it says we need a king, we need a king, we need a king. And the book of Ruth, which is the next book, is a sort of bridge book that introduces us just to one family. And we get one more genealogy. Remember, we're looking for the crusher. And the genealogy comes at the end of Ruth, where you get a great grandson of Ruth, whose name is David. And that introduces us to our point four, kings in the prototype kingdom. And it was always God's plan that there would be kings. Deuteronomy 17 talks about the king. And we're told a king can only be any good if he rules under God's authority. Not instead of God, but under God. Don't make the Genesis 3 mistake. Be God's delegate. Be God's stand-in. Don't be a replacement God. And they have a go with a king called Saul in 1 Samuel 8. And that's where they get wrong the first time. They ask for a king to be just like all the other nations' kings. A king who will be a replacement God. God says they're not rebelling against you, Samuel. They're rebelling against me. So God, if you like, he gives them the kind of king they ask for. He is big and he is strong. But when it comes to the crunch, 1 Samuel 15, he won't do what God says. So God rejects him. And even while Saul is still on the throne, God chooses a shepherd boy called David and anoints him king instead, which Saul doesn't enjoy very much. Kings tend not to enjoy there being a replacement around. So after years of hardship with Saul trying to get rid of David, David is made king. And David is a great king. He is the great king. He's the great warrior king. He defeats all of the enemies of Israel, from Goliath when he's still a boy, through every single ite and every single stein in the Bible. If you ever had to read those passages in church, trying to get all those names right, David defeats all of them. And for the first time, Israel has rest and is secure. If you imagine a map of the Middle East, David starts in the middle of Israel, and it's just push, 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 all the way through his reign as he defeats all of them and pushes out the boundaries until they match the biggest territorial area that was promised by God. So we need to put David on the diagram, and there he is, quite near the top. David is the one. And we're going to turn to 2 Samuel 7. But I think for sake of time, we're not going to do the exercise on the sheet. So turn to 2 Samuel 7, and with the next person, we're willing to read us verses 10 to 16 of 2 Samuel 7. Thank you. So this is the high point of David's career. He's been made king, and God makes a promise to him that should be sounding very familiar to us. Did you hear all the different pieces? So we'll have a permanent rest. That is a blessing word. Again, you could have people, place, and rest if you wanted. People, place, and relationship, people, place, and blessing, or people, place, and rest. A rest for the people, verse 10, people of Israel, in their own place, verse 10. Under David, we've assembled the pieces of the puzzle. We've assembled the prototype. Then there's also stuff about an offspring, verse 12. Somebody who comes out of David, David's offspring, and he will be a house. There's a kind of joke going on here. God's making a joke around the word house. There's going to be a house for David. That's like House of Windsor. Going to be a line of descendants, a royal house. But that offspring, they are going to build a house for me, God says, verse 13, as in temple. Going to build a place for God to live. And this offspring, he is going to rule forever, verse 13. He's going to be God's son, verse 14. And in the first instance, that is exactly what David's son Solomon does. So if we let's just get to Solomon. Solomon rules over the nation, and he builds a temple. Turn on to 1 Kings for a celebration at the very climax of the prototype. So 1 Kings chapter 4. And could someone read us verse 20 of 1 Kings 4? Thank you. There's people. And the promises in Genesis said either as many stars as there are in the sky or as much sand as on the seashore. And we've got that. And we have the people. Or we have place. Could someone read us verse 21? Thank you. This is the first land as promised in Genesis. And all the fighting is done. David did all the fighting. All Solomon has to do is be wise, rule well, and enjoy the blessings. And the relationship is stressed in those verses in the security and the wealth. All the kind of bits of grain and the cattle and all those blessings are all about the relationship blessings are there. Then there's just one more improvement that we make, which is that instead of a tent, Solomon does build God a house. So turn to 1 Kings 8, and we're just going to put that on the diagram as well. And that is meant to be a drawing of a temple. And you can draw that better if you want. And could somebody read us 1 Kings 8, verses 6 to 11?
And they are there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out from the land of Egypt. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord.
Thank you. Sound familiar? The ark goes in the tabernacle, a cloud fills it, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. So again, we have God with his people, but this time it has a degree of permanence, doesn't it? It's a solid stone-built house in a secure city. We've got a place to do the sacrifices, we have people, we have place, and we have relationship. The sort of one shape we've been following through the Bible all comes in here, and we say, well, look, we have built a fully working prototype. We've built the full thing. And if we worry that this isn't exactly Eden, well, I think Solomon is so glorious that we just put that aside and enjoy the party. Okay, I want to pause there. Oh, no, not on the diagram. There we go. I want to pause there at the climax of the prototype and just do another one of those driving it home to us. So we don't want this just to be knowledge. Don't want this just to be history. Kings and battles and things that happened. So let's drive this home to the faithfulness of God. If you're ever worrying how to apply the Old Testament to us, the best and easiest and safest way to apply the Old Testament is to remember that our God is the same as their God. So there may be all sorts of things that have changed and are different. I don't know if anyone's ever asked you the question about why is it we can't eat shellfish? Sorry, no, we can eat shellfish, can't we? Why is it we can eat shellfish and they couldn't? Because stuff has changed. But here's something that hasn't changed. God is always the same. Just look at the diagram and track it back, this sort of 1,000 year of history we've done. We've done about 1,000 years of history. You go back to one man, Abraham, right at the beginning. He has no children and no prospect of children because he is old. And all he has is a few promises from God. That's all he's got. And then you track it forwards up the slope to this kind of party in 1 Kings 8. And you look at Solomon, and you have to say, that is pretty amazing faithfulness of God. Through all of the possible things that could have derailed the promises, all of those promises have come true through such a long period of time, through so much rebellion. Do you remember Joshua 21? Verse 45, not one word of all the good promises the Lord made to the house of Israel had failed. They had all come to pass. Or 1 Kings 8, verse 20 and verse 21. Solomon is just amazed, isn't he? The Lord has kept the promise he made. I've succeeded David. I sit on the throne, just as the Lord promised. I have built the temple. I've provided a place for the ark. Everything God said has come true. But here's the thing. We have the same God. If you don't know this God yet, if you don't follow this God yet, don't you want to? This is the God who tells the truth, whose promises come true. And his promises to us of forgiveness, of I am with you always, of I will bring you to a land, to a new creation, bring you to heaven. Do you think after everything we've seen that God is going to let one of those promises drop? Do you really think he'll do promise 1, 2, 3, 4, 78, 90, 100, and then won't do promise 101? You might want to make a list of the promises he made before and how hard you think they were, and the promises he's made to us. Do you really think the promises to us are more difficult for a God like this? And that the New Testament uses the kind of characters we've seen here as lessons of faith. It says, now let's think about Abraham. He was 90 and he had no children, but he believed. Will you? Will you believe? Abraham was right to believe. It came true. Well, you think of Moses on his own in a desert against the superpower of the day on his own. Moses believed. Will you? Or you think of Joshua against the big armies and the cities of Canaan. He believed. Will you? Because your God is their God. Same person. And not one promise did he let slip. And actually we're warned as well not to be like the people who didn't believe God. Remember I said that belief is actually the fundamental response to God throughout the whole Bible. So remember the generation in Numbers who watched the plagues, all 10 of them. They watched the Red Sea. They met God at Sinai, but they learned nothing. And they got to the border of the promised land. They were put to the next test. Will I believe the next promise? And they didn't. And they all died in the desert. And the New Testament says, look at them. Learn from them. Learn from the, 4,000 years of history we're going to do in the end. Learn to trust God. He's the same. He's reliable. Well, let's just to make a little pause here. Why, if we're happy to, can we turn in our twos or threes and just take a second to pray? Would you be willing to do that? Just pray to that God who is trustworthy, faithful and reliable. Pray that we'd be given faith to trust him. So let's do that now. Just turn and pray. Okay, we could stop there, but we'd run out of time later and it would be far too happy a place to head off to lunch on. So we're not going to stop there. We're just going to destroy the prototype quickly before we go to lunch. Okay, so that's what we're going to do, is destroy everything. So turn the page and you'll see I've put prototype shelf life. We're not going to have time to look at that in detail. But that's some notes for you if you want to read Deuteronomy later on. Because Deuteronomy is a really interesting book. It's just before they go into the land. It's all about how to live in the land. And you'd expect it to be quite an upbeat book. Off you go, you know, you're going to get the land, God's promises are going to come true. But actually, it is a book all about exile. It's a book all about how the prototype has a shelf life stuck on it. So it's a bit like giving your son, the 17-year-old son, the keys to your Ferrari, saying, off you go, have some fun. But just before you start driving, here is a huge book of first aid. And here's a huge book of what to do when you have an accident. And actually, here's a song I'm going to teach you. There's a song in Deuteronomy that basically is the failure song. It's all about, here I am crashing your car, and now I've gone through the windscreen. And the whole book assumes this is all going to go horrendously wrong. So we heard to me earlier, it's blessings and cursings in Deuteronomy, but it's really clear where the emphasis is. The emphasis is on the curses. And it's basically a book about what's going to happen after you've broken it. What are we going to do next? So all along, we know we're going to destroy it. So it looks like, doesn't it, the diagram is heading up and up and up and up and up. But actually what we get is a ski jump, kind of Sochi Winter Olympics topical thing. Because the problem of sin is not solved. And the whole thing comes crashing down. That sin is a constant draw downwards, and we can't escape from it. And you can see sin in the lives of most of the significant individuals in there. So David, for example, for David it is murdering the husband of the woman he accidentally got pregnant after watching her in the shower. For Solomon, it is 300 concubines, which actually for Solomon is not quite enough for one for every day of the year, so he has 700 wives as well. And the problem with them is not even just the sheer scale of them, but is that each one of them has their own god. And Solomon is the great temple builder, so he builds each of them a temple to their own god. And actually it is just like us and creation. So we were the lords of creation. When we went wrong, all of creation went wrong. And the kings stand between God and his people. So if the kings go wrong, they lead everyone else off after them. And the history of Israel after Solomon is a history of progressively, bit by bit, God judging and destroying the kingdom of Israel. And it is very slow. You'd notice if you were to read through this bit of the Bible, it takes ages because God shows huge patience and he keeps warning them every single step of the way. He warns them not to do it. That is the second job of the prophets. Okay, that is not the diagram I was expecting. If you can see on page 10, you've got a drawing in very small print of where all the prophets come in the story of Israel. The second job of the prophets is to warn people to keep the covenant. And it's really good to know which prophet fits where. This is a diagram I've mostly nicked from Vaughan's book again, with a bit more detail on it. And it shows you which prophet is speaking when. It can be quite confusing in the Old Testament, particularly around the word Israel. So Israel is all of them, the 12 tribes. Then after they split, Israel is just the northern 10 tribes. That's okay, that's a bit confusing. And then once we've destroyed the 10 tribes, they start using Israel to refer to just the bottom two again. So it's very confusing. So it's good to have this diagram. This may be the most useful thing we do all weekend. Just cut that out, glue it into the front of your Bible. So you know that when you read Amos, you see, he's speaking to the northern kingdom shortly before they get destroyed. So the prophets warn them, but it doesn't do any good, and the whole thing is destroyed. So Solomon's son is a bit of an idiot, and the kingdom is divided in two. You get 10 tribes in the north, and a tiny group of 2 tribes in the south, with a king in David's line. So there's a problem. There's the line of the offspring of the eternal king, and they're split. And then every empire that you could go and see in the British Museum comes one by one and stomps on them. And 200 years later, it is finally the king of Assyria who destroys the northern kingdom, which is our first line down there. So the lost 10 tribes of Israel, if you've heard of that, that's them. They're destroyed and they are taken away. The book of Amos, one of the things Amos says, he warns them, they'll come and get you with fish hooks. Here's a babysitting idea that would work if you ever tried to control a class of children. Just put a fish hook through every nose. And tie them all to a piece of string and then come with me, and they all come with you. They're taken away into exile, mistreated, killed, resettled elsewhere. But then over 100 years later, the southern kingdom has learned nothing. They haven't learned, and twice it happens to them. That's the second line there, in 597 BC, 587 BC. This time it is the king of Babylon comes and destroys them. And Jerusalem is destroyed, and the people are scattered. And worst of all, just turn to 2 Kings 25. And could the next reader give us verses 4 to 7?
no food for the people of the land. And then the breach was made in the city, and all the men of the north fled by night by the way of the gate between the two walls by the king's garden. Though the Chaldeans were around the city, they went in the direction of the Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered before them. Then they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they passed sentence on him. They slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and bound him in chains, and took him to Babylon.
So the king, the offspring, who's going to rule forever, his job was to protect the people and save them. What happens when the Babylonians come? The king runs away. He flees. Does it do him any good? No. He gets captured. They take his children and kill them one by one in front of him while he watches. No more offspring. No more crusher. And then just for a bit of added cruelty, they put out his eyes. So the last thing he ever sees is his children being killed. And then he's taken away in chains. Or chapter 24, verse 13, tells us that the time before when they came, they took away from the temple all the things you need to make the temple work. All the gold things that Solomon made. Or 25, verse 9, we learn that they set fire to the temple of the Lord and the royal palace and all the houses of Jerusalem. So do you see how thoroughly we have destroyed this? We have no people because they're all either dead or in exile. We have no place because the Babylonians have conquered it and they're going to move other people into it to make them live there instead. We have no relationship because the temple has been destroyed. There's nowhere to do the sacrifices anymore. And we have no offspring because the king's children are all dead. There's no hope. It's all going to get destroyed. It's all been destroyed. So is this a disaster? Is this God's promises going wrong? Well, no, because this was always just the prototype. Do you remember this was the copy, the shadow, the illustration? This was always what God said would happen. Deuteronomy 29, Deuteronomy 30 say exactly this is what's going to happen far ahead in time. And also it's not a disaster because of the third role of the prophets. And here's where we're going to finish. Because they sort of launch off the ski slope. So we said prophets, they are mainly about relationship with God. Second thing they are is mainly about warning you not to break the covenant. But the third thing they are is about predicting the future. And even as the kingdom is collapsing around them, the same prophets, same warning prophets, they begin to make predictions. And they begin to make predictions that are huge, that are kind of far, far off and higher than Solomon. Claims that seem to go all the way up to Revelation 21 and 22. So time is up. So what I want to suggest is you can see on the point 8 there that there are four Old Testament passages. And I wonder if we could ask you just at some point this afternoon to have a skim through. Should we say, so Zechariah 9 down here at the front, Isaiah 65 there at the back, Jeremiah 31 at the back there, and Isaiah 53 down here. So if you wouldn't mind just having a quick skim at them so we know what we're hoping for when we come back this afternoon. Good. Do I hand back over to Andrew?